There's no ID playing. Stand back here at Radio Liberty, coming to the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that can determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us Jerry Guidetti, and Jerry is from the ARC Institute. We're going to be talking tonight about genetically engineered food. Now, to a lot of people, you sort of wondered why even bother to worry about that. After all, it's been cleared by the government. It must be safe. But I would ask the question, because it's been cleared by the government, can we be sure it's safe? We know that Vioxx was cleared by the FDA, despite the fact that before it was ever released, the 090 study, according to Dr. David Graham, showed that the use of Vioxx, low-dose Vioxx, increased the incidence of heart disease 700%. And the FDA knew that, and Merck knew that, and they released it without warning, and tens of thousands of people died. And they would still be selling it if David Graham, Dr. David Graham of the FDA, hadn't risked everything, his reputation, his family, his retirement, everything that tell the American people and testify before the United States Senate in November and tell the truth about what had happened. And if you haven't read Dr. Graham's testimony, that is our April newsletter, and if you'd like to get a copy of that, you just give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. We'll get you a copy of our April newsletter that'll tell you the story of BIOXX. But let's then go over to genetically engineered foods. We're assured by the FDA that they're safe, but, well, with us is Jerry Guidetti, and she's going to tell us about the study that was used by Monsanto to tell the FDA that this was perfectly safe to give to the entire world a new modified form of corn. So, Jerry, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
It's always a pleasure, Dr. Stan. Good to be here.
Why don't you go into the background of how it was that we now have this wonderful new form of corn that they've genetically modified every single molecule in the entire plant, and, of course, every kernel of corn, you know, in these plants, and probably this is 50% of the corn we're eating, and what do we know about it?
Sure. Well, back in 2003, this corn was released to the American public after what Monsanto says was a battery of toxicological studies. And in that battery of studies was a very small, from my professional point of view, very small study of rats. These were the live feeding studies, which Monsanto claimed in a press story I read that they didn't even have to do. They just did it just to be extra vigilant, you know. And in that study, they found some very disturbing effects. The first time it came to most of our attention is in November of 2004, when the French press and French Center for Food Safety alerted the EPA here in the United States and Monsanto that Monsanto had failed to comply with adverse reporting in that study, of effects in that study.
All right, we're going to be back here in just a few minutes with Jerry Guidetti. And Jerry, of course, is a genetic scientist. He's done been working in this field for many, many years. And she's left that field. She's actually working with the Arc Institute now and trying to inform the people of the potential danger of genetic engineering. Well, Dr. Stan, our guest, Jerry Guidetti. Jerry, why don't you go ahead and go into the background. So Le Monde, which is a French newspaper, had actually put out information that Monsanto really had not come completely forward and released this full report that they'd done, upon which the health of really the entire population depends. In other words, is this really safe, and what are the long-term results of it in the human population? So you pick up the story from there.
Sure. So Le Monde has asked that Monsanto, and so has CFS, the Center for Food Safety in France, has asked that the Monsanto Corporation release all, 1,130-some-odd pages of the study for public review and for scientific review. And, of course, Monsanto has not done that to date. At least we have not seen it yet outside in the press or even on the Internet. Monsanto has published on their website the summary of that study. Now, if you have a bit of science background and a bit of curiosity, you can see that there are indications in that abstract and in that summary of the abnormalities that they found. It's what they do with that data, what they say about that data, which is highly irregular and suspect, in my opinion. And to just give you background on the study, to make it as simple as possible, the corn was modified genetically by one so-called event. That is kind of an inside phrase for a coding sequence in the DNA that causes the production of a specific protein. That so-called event was placed in every single cell of the corn plant. You do it by genetic engineering. Now, the corn was dubbed by its event's name, M-O-N, as in MON-863. And it codes for, this particular gene or genetic sequence codes for, a protein, an insecticide. a protein called CRY, as in crybaby, CRY3BB1. Now, that insecticidal protein is actually a natural protein produced by one of nature's own bacteria called Bacillus thuringiensis. Now, we organic gardeners and farmers have been able to use Bacillus thuringiensis, or BT, for over 20, 25 years. You can get this from natural biological supply houses. You can spray it on your plants. And what you'll do to your plants is just dust the plants with these natural bacteria that they've grown up and multiplied. And along come caterpillars from leaf-eating insects. They eat up these bacteria. The bacteria get in. They have these insecticidal proteins inside of them. And then the caterpillar begins to...
Hold that thought right there. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Jerry was telling us that what has happened is that Monsanto has produced a new breed of corn. It's a breed of corn that has a gene in it called CRY3BB1. And, of course, this is a program to introduce into every molecule of the corn, every kernel of the corn, everything in the corn stalk, a specific type of gene that will actually be an insecticide and it will kill caterpillars. Now, ordinarily, you can spray this on the leaves of the corn or pretty any plant, and caterpillars will come along. They'll eat a little of the leaf. They'll get some of this insecticide into them, and the caterpillar just ups and dies. So, what a wonderful thing now. Of course, we're not going to spray it on the outside of the corn. We're going to put it within the corn itself. So, it's not simply what the caterpillar eats now, it's what we are going to eat in every ear of corn. And, of course, is this safe for human consumption? It kills the caterpillars. What does it do to human beings? Well, they don't know what it does to human beings, so they've done animal studies, and they've done an animal study on rats. So Jerry is going to tell us what the study, what happened when they fed this corn to rats over a period of, what, about 3 months or so?
90 days is all it was, and it was very interesting because generally when we do studies on rats, especially something so important as this, when you're going to release these things out into the environment, you do them on many, many more animals than were here. I looked in the beginning and saw, okay, there are 400 rats in the study, and in each test group, there were 20 males and 20 females, so a total of 40 animals in each test group. The first two test groups were the Mohn 863. One low dose, 11% of the corn event was in that particular corn sample, and the 33% was considered the high dose of that genetically modified corn.
In other words, 33% of the diet
was going
to be corn, and the other was
11%.
That's
low dose.
High dose or low dose? Go ahead.
Right, correct. Now, there were only 40 animals getting 11%, and there were 40 animals getting 33%. Now, this isn't a 400-rat study when you realize that you've only got 80 animals that are actually testing the GM corn. Only 80 rats. And then the rest of them were controls. There was a low-dose 11% of non-GMO corn, but of the same corn variety, and a so-called high dose at 33% non-GMO corn. There were 80 of those rats. Then all the rest of the rats, 320 other rats, all of the rest of them were, I'm sorry, is it 300? Yes, 320. All of the rest of them were other corn varieties.
There were 320 that didn't get the GMO.
That's correct. It did not, well, even more than that, because then there were the other controls. The only 80 of them, 20 and 20, right, males and females, got the genetically modified corn. So the corn was released, in terms of live studies, the corn was released to the American public based on their information on their own website, based on the study in 80 rats. Now, there were other toxicological studies done and so on, and they did a whole battery of those kinds of chemical tests, and they claimed from those chemical tests that these were not likely to cause problems.
What do you mean, not likely? I mean, can you say absolutely, or is it sort of one of those terms, well, not likely,
don't you love
or probably
it?
Not, or maybe not, or, you know, but not likely, is it, was that their term?
Right, not likely. I've seen that several places in their writings, not likely, and I could probably find them to read them to you directly where they came out with that. But here's again, we have to be very careful because we don't want to draw any conclusions that that are not based on fact. And so here we have their part of their conclusions here. There were no test article related, and they're referring to the genetic event as the test article, that genetically modified corn. There were no test article related deaths. There were two deaths from accidental killing during bleeding, or adverse clinical signs observed during the study. There were three unscheduled deaths among males, one non-transgenic, one in the high-dose group, one in the control group. And again, these were accidents, considered accidents, and not part of the study.
But we really don't know what
we
don't know what they died of, but they just happened to die while taking while being part of this study to determine if this is safe for us. But
and that's why we need to see the whole study, Dr. Stam. You see, you don't just take a summary and get all of the details. You get a summary here of how many deaths, when they were tested, what kind of tests were done on them. Samples, they look for microscopic lesions and all of that, and they tell you what they look for. So they make that conclusion in their introduction, and then they said there were no test article-related changes based on evaluation of survival, clinical signs, body weights, body weight changes, food consumption, clinical pathology, organ weights, macroscopic or microscopic pathology. Now, that's all in the introduction. And or the abstract, and then they go on to give you the summary of the study and the types of animals and so on, and they say that Monsanto Company has developed a corn event, Mon 863, to protect corn plants against feeding damage from corn rootworm larvae. Mind you, we are all being treated with the same insecticide if we're eating that corn as the larvae of the corn rootworm. And then in their, I'll get to their results here. It's rather astounding. They had hematology and coagulation parameters for the test groups were generally comparable.
Now, generally is sort of a vague term, and that could mean almost or maybe or.
That's a wiggle worm phrase. You know, you kind of wiggle in and you wiggle out of that. It's were generally comparable to the control and reference control groups. That's all of the others eating the other diets, not genetically modified.
Sounds like Bill Clinton, you know. It's all the determinant of what the meaning
what the word
of
is.
Is. Right, go ahead.
The few differences that were observed were generally, here's that word again, of small magnitude, which means, of course, that they weren't of all small magnitude, were not dose-related, that is, observed in the low dose but not in the high dose, or were observed at the interim but not at the terminal blood collection. So during the experiment when they collected the blood, they saw these effects, but not at the terminal when they killed them and bled them out.
But, of course, these did not occur in the non-GMO fed.
That's correct.
Right.
And
so these are very specific for the animals that are getting the GMO foods.
That's correct. And or were not consistently observed when compared to both the non-transgenic. Transgenic means the ones with transferred genes and reference control groups. For example, at week 5, this is quote, the hemoglobin level of the high-dose test males was outside the range of the reference control groups, but was significantly lower than the concurrent control.
Now, that's pretty fancy
yes.
footwork and wording, so most people would read that and say, I don't understand what that means.
That's right. It is quite fancy because you know what's inaccurate here for scientific lingo? The hemoglobin level of high-dose test males was outside the range, and then they have slash of reference control groups. Outside the range, do they mean higher? And then they say, but significantly lower than the concurrent control. That would be the ones that were eating the corn that was exactly the same variety, except it didn't have the genetic component in it, the genetic modification. And then they say, however, the hemoglobin level of the high-dose males was higher than the low-dose males. So they concluded there it demonstrated no dose response. But that is what they're using as the excuse to say that this isn't significant. Mind you, you didn't have any of these effects in any of the controls eating any of the normal grain. This only happened in those who ate the genetically modified grain.
No, it influenced the hemoglobin level, and I assume from that they were anemic of some sort.
Yes, and it looks like in some it was higher than, and then in others it was lower than, so it was inconsistent. And then it says no similar statistical differences were seen at week 14. Week 14 is the end of their study. At week 14, the mean basophil count, as you know, is one of the white blood cells, lymphocyte count, which is another type of white blood cell, and total white cell counts were slightly but statistically significantly higher in the male group fed the high-dose test diet than males fed the high-dose control. Now, you know and I know, Dr. Stan, that high white cell counts, especially abnormal in one cell or another, is often indicative of types of leukemia, correct?
Well, it can be. It could mean that there's some sort of a response going on. In other words, the human immune system is reacting
to this genetically
modified corn, but they don't seem to be very worried about that.
No. As a matter of fact, the white cell count may be going up because they see this as a foreign invader, and it's alarmed, and the immune system is beginning to respond. And mind you, this was at week 14, and week 14, do the math, this is toward the end. This is the end of the experiment, is it not? Yes, 14-3, yes. Okay, so that would be toward the end of the experiment that they saw these results. And mind you, why didn't we continue past 90 days then? You know, why were the animals sacrificed at that point? We can only guess. However, the increases were small, and a similar response did not occur in females. So now they're using that as, well, we weren't worried about it because it was only in the males and it wasn't in the females. These changes are not attributed to dietary administration of the test article. How do you like that?
Well, why would they say that if you only found those in the animals
and the rats
that, of course, were being fed, at least in the males, were being fed the genetically modified food? I think our listeners have to understand we're talking about hundreds of millions, if not billions, of dollars of profit. Can we really trust corporations, to be honest, to be concerned about our health? Many years ago, of course, we gave women diethylstilbestrol during the pregnancy to keep them from having miscarriages. And, of course, their daughters developed CA, cancer of the vagina, cancer of the cervix. Their sons developed cancer of the testes and increased in significant numbers. But it took 20 years to find out what would happen. Well, we've only been eating this corn for 2 years. What's it going to do to us in the future? Does anybody really care in government? As long as they get the promotions, as long as they get their transfer to the drug companies making good money? Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Jerry Guidetti. Jerry, why don't you pick up then with your interpretation of what we've been talking about?
Sure. Well, now we have male rats who have hemoglobin abnormalities. It has only occurred in the genetically modified grain group, has not occurred in any of the controls, which were the larger population of rats, by the way, or all of the controls and the reference controls. So this is a small group of male rats, say 20 in one group, low dose, 20 male rats in the other group, low dose, and you're looking at hemoglobin abnormalities in the males. Now we get to the females. Clinical chemistry results of the test groups were generally similar to the control and reference control groups. Here we go again. There's that magic word. Only, that's a qualifying word. It doesn't belong there. They say only the triglyceride value was statistically significantly higher in the female rats fed the high-dose test diet relative to the high-dose control and reference control groups at week 5. No similar response was seen in males at either sampling interval. So now they're using the excuse, you know, can use the excuse in their logic. The females had it, but not the males, and they're not concerned. The increase in mean triglycerides in test high females at week 5 was small, and the mean value was within plus or minus one standard deviation of the mean of the reference group, and so on. There were no other chemistry parameters associated with this change that would indicate a pattern of alteration. Mind you, now they're looking for a pattern among this small group of females. This slight difference was not considered to be test article related. because of the lack of dose response and the inconsistency of the changes across time. Once again, here we go. It didn't matter that it was only in the test group. It didn't matter that it was in the small handful of animals. It didn't matter that there were inconsistent changes across the group. Your body, Dr. Stan, or mine might respond to things differently. So will our children's respond differently to drugs, to anything in the environment. What is to make them feel that you can't have inconsistent responses due to the assault of a chemical in the body? Of course you're going to have inconsistencies. How much did that particular rat eat and so on? This does not mean that there were no effects. Now, add to that that when they did the gross and microscopic pathology after they sacrificed these animals, it's amazing how it's just kind of fluffed off. Histomorphological examination, slicing up, taking a look at it under the scope and looking at the general morphology or shape and size and so on of tissues, representing major organ systems, found no test-related alterations. Again, they make the statement. Then they say the statistically significant lower incidence of a common kidney lesion, in parenthesis, tubular mineralization in high-dose test females compared to high-dose control females is of no biological importance and not considered to be test-related, test article-related. It's astounding. They even had kidney changes. Now, the French press said that the kidney changes included a shrinking or smaller-sized kidney in the males than the females. And here we find out that it changed the incidence of a common kidney lesion.
Hold that thought there for just a moment.
Sure.
Well, Dr. Stan, our guest is Jerry Guidetti, and we're going over the report from LeMond that was analyzing the Monsanto report. What they found, of course, was that in females, rats, why they had a higher triglyceride level. In other words, these are the bad cholesterols or bad fats that are within our system. But they said, well, it wasn't very high, and it didn't occur in the males, so we weren't going to worry about it. They found out that, of course, when they analyzed the tissues, that women, finally female rats, had tubular mineralization, in other words, changes within the structure of the kidneys, but since it didn't occur in the males, they really weren't too worried about that. Apparently, the males had smaller kidneys, the test rats, than the non-test rats. Now, you have to understand what we're really talking about is totally changing the diet of the American people. We know, for instance, that J.D. Searle got NutraSweet legalized. NutraSweet contains methanol. You know what methanol is? That's what you drink it. It makes you go blind. It contains aspartic acid and phenylalanine, both in at least the aspartic acid is an excitotoxin, and in significant amounts can be extremely toxic to the brain, as can phenylalanine. Specific people, some people have real problem utilizing phenylalanine. In fact, we test every child born in the state of California for their ability to metabolize phenylalanine, because if you can't metabolize it, you're in real trouble. But we're giving this a NutraSweet, and we know the disastrous effects it has as far as producing pathological obesity. And oh shucks, the FDA and the CDC and the NIH just can't figure out why we have so much obesity, knowing full well that the studies done back in 1970 and again in 1980 by Dr. Olney, and we'll provide this for any of you who want to see the studies because we have them, shows that animals, and it doesn't matter what the animal is, any animal you feed NutraSweet 2 will become pathologically obese. That's why they give this to cattle now when they're young, so they'll become extremely obese and they get more money for them. There'll be a lot more fat in the meat. They know exactly what it does to animals, and that's why they're giving it to human beings, and they're actively concealing this information. If you want the documentation for what I'm saying on NutraSweet, well, you want to go to Doorway, DORWAY.com, that's doorway.com. Get the information, understand what we're up against. We're up against officials that have an agenda of their own. There are people who are really not concerned about our health, And that's why you're going to have to learn these things and find out. Well, our guest is Jerry Gudetti, and she's going through all these findings that were in the Monsanto report. Is that Monsanto report up on their webpage?
Yes. Let me give you exactly the information, because we always want to be sure that folks have the source so they can check everything out themselves. Go to Monsanto's website, and you'll find a report number, M as in Mary, Sam L, MSL-18175, MSL-18175. Now, this the way I got it was I was hunting for the rat study, because I was hoping they had posted the entire study, the entire deal, and they didn't. This is 11 pages long, and it's very interesting that they call this a toxicology report summary. It is a summary. It's not classic toxicology. I mean, it's a live animal feeding study is what it is. They call it 13 weeks, yet they are quoting 14 weeks throughout the study. There are inconsistencies in there. And, well, maybe they're counting the 14th week as the baseline food consumption before the study. Perhaps that's what they're talking about. At any rate, the study was conducted December 18th, 2002. The corn was released to the American public in 2003. And the French, the whole European Union, you know, to the protest of so many of the people, their governments just lifted the ban on genetically modified foods. So
over the objection of the people.
Over the objection of the people,
well,
absolutely.
Of course, but the governments really aren't concerned. After all, there are too many people there anyway, especially the older people.
Well, they are insured. They are insured by this company and by our government that all of this is safe and should not cause any harm. And when you read some of the review agencies' consensus of opinion on this, you'll find one group said that they were very concerned. As a matter of fact, here is a direct quote from, from Le Monde, quoting the CFS in France, "For a corn crop being eaten by a large part of the U.S. population, reasonable prudence demands that the rat study be reviewed immediately by the EPA," said Doug Gurian Sherman, senior scientist with CFS. "Further delay in reviewing the study unnecessarily exposes U.S. consumers to unknown health risks. The lack of a clear finding of safety so far demonstrates that Monsanto's Mon 863 corn can no longer be considered safe to a reasonable certainty."
And, of course, the thing is that Monsanto refuses to release that.
That's correct.
You know, and, of course, we're so concerned about Osama bin Laden over in a cave in Pakistan. Maybe the ultimate terrorists really aren't in Pakistan.
Uh-huh.
Maybe they're working right there in Washington, D.C.
I would have to tell you that
hold
it
that
really
thought.
Does.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Jerry Gudetti, and we're simply commenting that we're very concerned. The government's here to protect us. No, the government is not here to protect us. We're going to have to protect ourselves. Our founding fathers did not trust government. They wanted to limit the power of government. They never wanted to give the government the authority to tell us what food we could and couldn't eat, and certainly not to legalize the distribution of food. When even government officials are not allowed to see the complete report, we're told we can trust the corporations like Enron and like Global Crossing and like Health South, and we can trust them. The corporations would never lie to the American people, or would they? And now, of course, we're going to trust them with our health. We're going to trust the government, the same government that gave us the Tuskegee study, that gave women the Stilbestrol, they gave us Vioxx, and of course Crestor. We won't get into that tonight, but there's so many things that they're doing to harm our health, and if you listen to our programs, you realize that. Well, pick up the story there, Jerry. Anyway,
sure.
You're concerned about what's going on,
and
of course the people in Europe are concerned, but there's nothing they can do about it because they've been betrayed by their governments too, haven't they?
Right, they certainly have, and unfortunately it is our government's position, since we are the developer of the original Terminator gene that's designed to kill the ability of all seeds to germinate in order to protect the profits and business interests of our multinational corporations. We have developed that, and the USDA, with our tax money, has informed the world, and I have that up on our website, by the way, ARK, ARKinstitute.com. go to the food supply updates. Look at the first article I wrote in 1998, blowing the whistle on this Terminator being released to the public. It was scheduled for release 2003. It's now being tested in fields in other countries. At any rate, our position then was quoted by then-spokesman Phelps as, we expect to have this patent approved in 78 countries around the world, and the USDA is supposed to be getting royalties for this. Some 5%, I believe, is the number that he quoted. I was astounded. I was so upset over it. I was, at the time, working in genetic engineering, saw the problems that this posed for even life on the planet. I know that sounds like an overstatement, but I assure you it's not, because the pollen in these things literally can blow in the wind, as can this corn's pollen, MON 863, blow in the wind as well, and spread itself all over. Now, if this isn't...
hold this off right now. Yes. We want to bring our stations right back on board here, and we'll be right back in a moment. Well, Dr. Stan back here, our guest is Jerry Guidetti, and before we go on with this incredible discussion, and these are not the things you're going to hear elsewhere, but ladies and gentlemen, if you're not concerned about what's going on, who's going to be? Certainly not the government officials, many of whom are getting, at least we know the NIH are getting, even more from the drug companies that they're supposedly having a dealing and protecting us from, than they're actually getting from their large government salaries. You know, a couple of scientists there get close to $200,000 a year, and then they're getting large supplements from various companies supposedly they're going to be protecting us from. So do you honestly believe that the people who are getting large sums of money from other companies, from companies, are going to use their positions in government to protect us, or that the FDA officials who are planning on going to work for the drug companies when they retire are really going to be concerned about your health? Well, right now I want Jerry to tell you a little bit about the ARC Institute and about how you can get in touch with her and get onto her website. Could you give that website once again for our listeners?
Sure. The website is ARC, think of Noah's Ark, A-R-K, Institute.com. All lowercase is fine, ARCInstitute.com. And be sure you look at the food supply updates. It's a free newsletter. You'll have wonderful background on what's going on with genetic modification of seeds, food seeds in particular. We are a botanical Noah's Ark for old varieties of seeds that are non-GMO, not genetically modified. They are non-hybrid. These are the seeds that you can grow year to year yourself by growing up your fruits and vegetables, cutting open those fruits and vegetables, taking the seeds out, saving them for next year. Our seeds can be frozen for many years. They'll last as long as 40 years or more. You can take out one variety a year and test it out in the field and so on. But what's most important here, Dr. Stan, is that the seeds are disappearing at an absolutely alarming rate. And unless folks like your listeners, you and me, unless we preserve them, we are going to be in trouble so fast, because what has happened, our major supplier of vegetable seeds to this country, 40% of all the food vegetables, food seeds that we raise our vegetables and fruit with, Semini Seed Company of Mexico, has just been bought by Monsanto. 2,000 varieties, you'll find that article up on the website, again, arcinstitute.com. 2,000 varieties were removed from the market in the year 2000. Check that out. We suggest that you purchase, for the only time you'll ever have to do it in your life, a collection of seeds, 20 or 40 varieties, from the ARC Institute, or get them from friends who you know are preserving heirlooms. And take these seeds and preserve them. Learn how to grow them. They're not difficult, even if you specialize in one tomato this year and corn next year and so on. Preserve them, because you will only be able to retain your right and ability to feed yourself for a very short time, because these pollens are out there. They're going to be crossing with every variety that is grown in this country. It's all over the world now. We've introduced them to Mexico. We've got them all around the world. Unfortunately, the pollen's blowing in the wind. The seeds are contaminating the natural, the God-given genes that we have to work with. in these all of these original heirlooms, and we've got these strange genes, such as this insecticidal protein gene, this CRY 3 gene. We've got these things floating around that are going to enter our standard corns, and we really ask you folks to take seriously the work of preservation of these varieties, because pretty soon the contamination issue, the genetic contamination issue, is going to be so huge and so severe that it's going to be difficult finding, one, the smoking gun, what is it that's causing the ailments that we see in humans and animals, and two, how do you put the genie back in the bottle? You don't do it. Now, I don't know if you saw, Dr. Stan, the report that just came out of the journal Nature. This month's issue is, and it'll knock your socks off, there is a phenomenal discovery that has been made by several research groups at the best research centers in this country, Cold Spring Harbor, National Human Genome Research Institute, Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, and so on, Broad Institute of MIT and Harvard. All of these institutes are working and have discovered these little tiny pieces of genetic material called microRNAs or microribonucleic acids. They have discovered they actually play a role in triggering cancer. They didn't know it before, and now they're thinking these microRNAs are actually oncogenes or cancer-causing genes. And you know why that's important in this discussion? It's important because I have been talking for years about the fact that introducing foreign genes into the DNA of other organisms, like our food, introduces into our bodies foreign proteins that our bodies have no experience with. There have been studies in insects that show that some of these genes are taken up into the gut cells of insects, for example. If we are incorporating any of these foreign genes into our own bodies, into our own cells, there is the potential for these genes to code for messenger RNAs, RNA segments, which are programming them to produce proteins that our bodies have never seen before. Now, seeing this microRNA series of articles appearing in this month's issue, the June 9th issue of the journal, the scientific journal Nature, just released, it shows that these tiny pieces, only 22 nucleotides long, of RNA may actually be the switch, the oncogene that turns cancers on and off.
And okay, you're going to have to get that article to me, and maybe we'll talk a little bit about that next month, because I think that's fascinating.
Absolutely, and it may tie right into what's going on with genetic engineering.
Well, let's get your telephone number out. How can people get in touch with you if they're interested in learning more about what you're doing?
1-800-255-1912, 1-800-255-1912. Call the ARC Institute. Kristen's there. You can talk to her about some of the things we talked about tonight, and she can help you get your own collection. And by the way, you know this, Dr. Stan, maybe your listeners don't know it. The ARC Institute has always asked that you don't come back again to buy any more seed, because you won't have to. Then we'll know that you're doing your job. You don't have to, because you can take our seed, you can grow it, you can multiply it yourself, and you will have seed to feed yourself, your neighbors, your friends, your family for the rest of your life, just the way it used to be.
And, of course, you actually have a book there that tells them how to prepare the seeds, and then you even, of course, tell them how they can actually put the seeds that you send them and freeze them. But you have to know what you're doing. Don't just put them in the freezer. There are certain things you have to do along with that.
Right. Always think of putting water in an ice cube tray, putting it in the freezer, and you know that if you overfill the ice cube tray, the ice cubes, the water will overflow, and the ice cubes actually get bigger, because water is unusual in that when you freeze it, it doesn't shrink, it actually expands. Well, the same thing happens with the natural low-level moisture that's inside cells. Even dried seeds have some moisture in the cells. Well, what you want to do if you're going to freeze them for very long-term storage, you know, years and so on, you put in some drying agent like silica gel. You can get that in a craft store or a gun shop. Gun shops use it to keep powder dry. Craft stores have it as a flour drying agent. Most of the folks at craft store don't know the word silica gel, but tell them you want the stuff to you, that you dry flowers with, and you'll see silica gel. One of the names of these products, for example, is called Flower Drying Art, A-R-T. The silica gel can be placed in a mayonnaise jar. Get yourself a nice new canning lid from your grocery store. You can get a whole sleeve of them for a couple of bucks, of 12 of these. Screw on these nice new canning jars after canning lids on your jar after you fold up as many packets of our seed as you can fit into the jar. Screw on the cap with the silica gel inside the jar, and the silica gel will draw all of the remaining moisture out of the cells down to about 8 to 10% moisture. That's safe. If you keep them on your counter drying out for 5 to 7 days, they will be so dry that you can then pop that dry jar right into your freezer. As a matter of fact, if you do it fast enough, you can even open the lid, dump out the silica gel to use for another jar, and pop the seeds in just like that. Just make sure you screw it down tight, put it in your freezer. People ask me, what happens if the electric fails? Don't worry about it. Seeds aren't going to change in that amount of time. You can take those jars, you can move to a new house, take them and stick them in the freezer again, as long as you don't crack the seal on your jar. When you need to take your plant, your seeds out the following spring, quickly undo the jar, pop out the envelopes that you want, put the lid right back on again. If you have the lid off for hours, then stick some more silica gel in there again, screw it down, let them dry out again for another couple of days, and pop them in the freezer. Now, doing that, you've got tremendous food security. You can pack those jars. You can take them, as I said, with you. When you move someplace else, and God forbid we have a huge terrorist event or some other great calamity in this country, in years to come, you at least have the means to start all over again.
Well, I think, you know, people have to understand that there really are people in this country who have a different worldview. Mm-hmm. And you only need to, of course, read my Population Control Agenda monograph. It's available at my website at radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. And we'll give you a great deal of information on population control. One of these days I'll have to update it, but it's still one of the best things that's available anywhere in the country and on the Internet. But go to our website, radioliberty.com, read the Population Control Agenda monograph, and then put it into the context of what we're talking about. Monsanto has been involved in a number of things which I feel have been flagrantly dishonest. They know exactly what they're doing, and they're totally unconcerned about your health as far as the fact that they put things on the market that were totally unsafe, and they've never had to answer for it. And now, of course, they've changed the laws so we can't bring class action suits in state courts. Why? To protect corporations like Monsanto and Lilly and Merck and Pfizer and those corporations that contribute so generously to the finest politicians that money could buy in Washington, D.C. So anyway, I think that this is really a very, very serious matter. If you have a quick question for us, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. And remember, it'll take 10, 20, 30 years before we know the deleterious effects of what's going on in China. They're experimenting with new types of rice, but they're not releasing it to everybody. They're trying it in several specific areas so they don't damage the health of everybody in China. They're experimenting on their people. But I think the people here in the United States must understand, here we're not experimenting on one group. We're experimenting on the entire population with a product that they know produces physiological response as far as the kidneys is concerned, as far as the white count is concerned, as far as the triglycerides are concerned. And they say, well, generally, there's not much difference. What does generally mean? Do you really want to trust your life and the life of your family and your future generations to semantics, the use of terms like generally and most of the time and primarily. And no, ladies and gentlemen, they're playing games. But believe me, if there's a problem, nobody's ever going to be punished for it. Millions and millions and millions of people have died of cancer from tobacco. Nobody's going to prison for that, or they may have to pay some money for it. Have you noticed that nobody, even the people who perjured themselves testifying before Congress, has ever been charged? Have you ever wondered why? Is it possibly that they were doing what people wanted done? After all, there really are too many people in the world, aren't they? Let's go to Mary calling from Covina. Hi, Mary. How are you?
Hi, Dr. Stan. I would like to ask your guest, is that corn, is that the corn that we get in Mexico, too? Could not tell you whether that specific variety is in Mexico. I can tell you that we have shipped so many genetically modified seeds of corn down to Mexico purportedly for feed and for human consumption, when, of course, we knew full well that the folks would plant some of that seed. And what happened, unfortunately, is they did exactly that. They saw these nice, big, brand-new seeds. I mean, I've got the same sins. I see beautiful new seed, and I say, oh, gosh, you know, I wonder what this will look like when it grows, because you see in every seed potential. Well, they did this down in Mexico, and Mexico is generally considered kind of the cradle of corn civilization. The oldest variety, Tio Sintes, are down there in Mexico. And we consider that the most beautiful, bountiful biodiversity in terms of genes for corn stalks. And unfortunately now, we have contaminated it right on down to the southernmost reaches of Mexico. And scientists, true good scientists who are looking for genes to help in natural breeding experiments, as corn was meant to cross, hoping to find corns with greater resistance disease and so on. Now they're concerned that these genes are down there, and we have, you know, all of these strange new entities, these chemical entities introduced into genomes. We have no idea what effect they're going to have on the plant's growth and development. We have no idea what it's going to have on the people and the animals down there.
Well, of course, now then there's the Roundup Ready corn. They put another gene into the corn.
Yeah, Roundup, don't even get me started on that. There are more studies that just came out that the glyphosate, which is Roundup, kills amphibians. And so here we have Roundup Ready canola, Roundup Ready corn. Roundup Ready wheat is going to be going on the market soon, although farmers have been fighting it like crazy. Now that gives them carte blanche to spray Roundup all over the wheat fields, all over the corn fields, all over the bean fields, canola fields, saturating the soils with this stuff in order to control weeds. And in the process, we are denuding the earth of amphibians. Now, what effect is that going to have on insect populations? Insects that attack corns.
Well, I think that people really see that this sounds really sort of like just, alarmist. Why you know, the government would never allow anything that was harmful for us to happen, would they? Mm. Or is it possible that there really are evil and wicked people in the world? And I will tell you, I met many of them when I was in the California Medical Association. They knew that many of the policies that were being recommended by the California Medical Association were harmful. And, of course, they held the reins of power, and they would ridicule and demonize people like me who tried to speak out and try to let the other doctors know what was going on. Well, we'll be back here in just a moment. Hey, anything else you want to say, Mary?
I did have a couple of
things. Well, then you hang right on. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, Dr. Stan, we've got Jerry Guidetti as our guest. And Mary, did you have another question you wanted to ask?
Yeah, I'm wondering about our fruit trees. Are they going to be okay? Have they done anything with this genetically modified stuff for fruit trees where in time they may get contaminated?
Okay. Thus far, the fruit trees are okay, other than they are chemically sprayed with tons of chemicals that are now suspect. There are a lot of cancer-causing chemicals, as you know. If you raise fruit on trees organically, you can count on your fruit being quite healthy.
we are not introducing the genetic cell-by-cell changes in fruit as we're doing, although we are doing a little bit more with small fruits like strawberries, but in general, you get one strawberry, they clone them, they don't let them cross naturally form seed and so on, they clone them, you know, they're kind of tasteless. Those things are bred specifically for shipping, hard, firm, slow ripening and so on, slow to rot. That's why they don't taste so good.
And that thing that's really so amazing for our listeners to understand, why don't strawberries taste like strawberries anymore? Because
well,
they're really not strawberries. They're modified, genetically modified, so that they will last longer, so they'll look good, but they just don't taste like that wonderful sweet flavor we used to associate with strawberries.
Unfortunately, we've lost a lot of that flavor. You know, used to be that wild turkeys were very smart, and unfortunately, as we bred our wild turkeys into domesticated varieties and bred them for bigger and bigger and bigger breasts, their brains got smarter, smaller and dumber, and as a result of that, the turkeys have to be taught to drink and eat. They are probably among the dumbest of all animals, but that's because we, in our infinite wisdom, have taken away their brains in order to give them larger quantities of breast meat. And so sometimes we don't see past the ends of our own noses, and we are arrogant about a lot of the changes that we make and don't recognize that we are really playing with fire in many of these cases.
Mary, I want to thank you so much for calling.
Can I ask one more thing?
Well, quickly, because we're almost out of time.
I've noticed that a lot of the jars that contain the stuff that we buy, they're going from glass to plastic.
Yeah.
That's not good, is it?
Well, I'll tell you, there are plasticizers that leak out into food, different kinds of plasticizers. What they don't tell you, for example, some of those hard polyethylenes that are used to make the water bottles, for example, they're really designed for only one use. And so many of us refill those again. There are plasticizers that leak into food, but some plastics are considered very food safe. Glass is the safest of all. If you'll do your own canning, or buy glass, you're, I think, better off.
Thank you.
Well, this is Dr. Stan and Jerry. I want to thank you so very much for being with us. It's always a pleasure having you. We'll look forward to talking to you next month.
My pleasure, Dr. Stan.
And let's get that telephone number out just one more time.
Sure. 1-800-255-1912.
Good night.
Good night.
Bye.
God bless.
Okay, fine. That was Jerry Guidetti, and I think Jerry's a fascinating, fascinating guest. She does help support Radio Liberty, but I think her message is right on, which is why we encourage her to be on as much as possible. Now, I do want to comment that we do carry a book called Seeds of Deception by Jeffrey Smith. That's Seeds of Deception, Going into Genetic Engineering. We carry another book called GMOs, Beware Genetically Modified Foods. We have a 4-tape set on the genetic engineered food. That's a genetic engineered food. So they're all available by calling 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. We can only cover a certain amount of in an hour, but I think with those 4 one-hour tapes and, of course, reading the books, you'll begin to get a grasp of what we're up against. You'll even learn more if you get my monograph, The Population Control Agenda. Now, we have a 4-tape set on population control. We have a video on population control. And we have the monograph we're talking about. It's entitled The Population Control Agenda, and you can get that by itself, or you can certainly get that if you get one of the other items, just ask for it. We'll be glad that we got to send that along for you, or you can go up to our website at radioliberty.com and pull that down. If you really doubt that there really is a master plan for mass destruction of humanity, you need to get our 4-tape set called The New Order of the Barbarians. It's based upon interviews with Dr. Dennegan, who back in 1969 had heard Dr. Richard Day, who was the medical director of Planned Parenthood, telling about the ultimate plan of a group he called the Order. The people who worked behind the scenes through Planned Parenthood and the other organizations he was affiliated with. And their plan was really to create new diseases, to kill off large parts of the population, to suppress treatments for cancer. This is 1969. If you want to hear an amazing four-tape set, of all the four-tape sets we have, this treat indeed is one of the most amazing we have, and there actually is a transcript of the at least three of the interviews, those that were done by somebody else. I did one of the interviews because I really wanted to talk to Dr. Dennegan and convince myself his story was true before I began to circulate it. You can, of course, get my interview in the four-tape set on Gina's side. We have so much information. Remember our number. It's 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And then, of course, we hope you'll go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. And, of course, you can pull down our programs there 5 hours a day on the Internet through the various networks we're affiliated with, AmericanNewsNet.com, GCNLive.com, RBNLive.com, SoundWaves2000.com. But, of course, the easiest way is to go to RadioLiberty.com, and you can listen to our programs. And please encourage others to listen to our programs. Are we alarmists? Yes. Because we're involved in a battle with people who are inherently evil. There are people who have an entirely different worldview, who worship a different God, who dream a different dream, who have a different vision of what the world should be. And that world will have very, very few people in it. Understand what we're up against. My book, Brotherhood of Darkness, will give you more information than any other book I know. That's Brotherhood of Darkness, or Marlon's book. It's called Lucifer's Children. Pray for America. Please pray for revival. Pray for our leaders and our ministers, but pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. To those, of course, who are leaving us now, why, we'll be back again on Monday. For those who are staying on, well, we'll be back as soon as we're through the break. Stand back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us on the line Mr. James Roots. We're going to be talking about his book, Mega Shift. It's a fascinating book, and we appreciate your being with us this evening. Thank you so much for being our guest tonight here at Radio Liberty.
Good to be with you.
Well, tell us a little bit about yourself. You mentioned, of course, that you've been done a lot of things. You've been in search of spirituality. And in recent years, of course, you've become aware of the fact that there seems to be a reawakening of Christianity, not necessarily here in the United States or in Western Europe, but certainly in Africa and in China and in South America, and that the Christian church, the Protestant church, seems to be growing very, very rapidly in those areas. Would you like to sort of pick up on that idea?
Oh, yeah. Well, certainly. First off, the name is Brutz instead of Roots. In the old country, it would be Roots. I stick to Roots here. The history, if you look at it, of the last century, starting in 1900, we had about 2 million evangelical Christians in Africa. Now there's 200 million. In Latin America, you had about 1 million really born-again people. Now there's 170 million. And in China, of course, it's a famous case. When Mao came in 49, there was fewer than a million Christians. Now, by my count, there's somewhere between 115 and 120 million, in about 50 years. And since the 60s, some people think, oh, well, those numbers must be dying off, because so many things have been going wrong. But actually, I found and announced in my book, Megashift, that there is a really hot, growing core of the church, evangelicals and charismatics mostly, that has been growing at 8% a year since 1970. And that's really fast if you're familiar with statistics and how things grow.
All right, fine. And Chris, why is this happening in other countries and yet not really happening here in America? Of course, we have a lot of people who are nominal Christians, but so many of our Christians here, many of them don't even believe in the basic tenets of Christianity. They sort of go to church because it's a stylish thing to do, but why is Christianity growing in other countries so much more so than here and in Western Europe, which were really the centers of Christendom for 1,000 years?
Yeah, well, you're very right. Several reasons. One is that a lot of this growth is being driven by miracles. As people see God's power, they tend to turn to Him. And the further out in the boondocks you are, the more that God, in emergencies, is plan A and plan B and plan C, because there isn't any help. We don't need God that much here in America, frankly. We have doctors all over the place, and we can get a lot of help with our medical problems, and it's a fairly rich country, and so we're not desperately poor. We're not motivated to turn to Him like they are overseas in many cases.
Well, just noticed in your story, you tell about some people in Muslim countries that have had supernatural experiences and have actually had some sort of an apparition or some sort of a spiritual experience. I've heard this from other missionaries to the Muslim world, how often Muslims will have Jesus come to them in a vision or in a dream, yeah, and tell them that. Yeah, and this I remember one missionary I was talking to. He told him 20 or 30 people who had told almost the same identical story. Of course, in the Muslim world, you convert to Christianity, that's sort of like signing your own death warrant. And yet, these people are so convicted that they do, and they become spokesmen for our Lord.
Yes, yes. Well, there is a death warrant problem, particularly in places like Sudan and Saudi Arabia. But as far as we can guess, and don't ask me to back this up, but our guess is, from people in the field, Jesus has appeared to about 1 million Muslims, usually in night vision. And sometimes a village will wake up and say, everybody will be running around saying, did you see a white man in your dreams last night? He always appears as a white man dressed in white robes for reasons, don't ask me why. And about 7 times out of 10, something like that, he will say some version of, I am the way and the truth and the life, and no man comes to the Father but by me, which of course is exactly what Muslims need to get straight. And so that is something that really shows us that God is really interested in impacting this whole Muslim problem we have all over the world. I think you're old enough to remember back when everyone was saying, boy, it's going to take a lot of Christian blood spilled to get through to the Muslim community. But now we see God is going out there in front of us. And just recently there was a Sheikh Ahmad Al-Qahtani, one of the most respected clergy teachers in Libya, who got on Al Jazeera TV and complained that 6 million Muslims a year are now deserting Islam and becoming Christians. And that's from the mouth of the opposition, so to speak. So that is pretty remarkable. That wasn't happening a few years ago.
Well, Chris, you talk in your book about Mr. Bonnke, Reinhard Bonnke, who's he's South African, evangelist. Big pardon?
German.
German, okay. He's a German evangelist. And he's really going all over Africa, having a profound effect.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's astonishing. And, of course, the Muslims and witch doctors, too, try to shut him down. And a lot of opposition, but he's better known than Billy Graham over there, I'm sure. He's a lot of Muslims coming to the Lord.
And I think the interesting thing is, of course, I lived in Africa for a time, and there really are demonic strongholds there. I mean, I practiced medicine, and of course, most of my patients would go to the witch doctor before they came to the white doctor.
Uh-huh.
And so there, of course, when we see this real spiritual warfare that's going on, why, of course, I think God does intervene on the side of righteousness, on his side, you know, and certainly if people are faithful, why, you can counter the truly demonic effect. I mean, it's openly demonic, so much of what goes on in Africa today.
Yes, but you have raw spiritual power there, good and bad, and that's one reason. I mean, Africa is just one portion of the world, but I've found, as you probably discovered in my book, that there's now 52 countries I've documented where God has brought people back from the dead, not these near-death experiences where somebody goes down a tunnel and sees a light and all that, but really stone-cold dead people, and they've been brought back in the name of Jesus. That kind of power floating around is really empowering for the ordinary person.
Well, I think that that gets their attention. Unfortunately, rational people have a very hard time sometimes believing in the supernatural. I think this is one reason why so many educated people, doctors, lawyers, reject Christianity, because it isn't rational. We're not talking about something that's rational. We're talking about something that's supernatural. And I think that most people, at least certainly in underdeveloped countries, recognize there is a spirituality, there is a spiritual world out there. We're just too smart here to recognize it.
Yeah. Well, it's not as though we're sub-rational. It's super-rational. It includes a lot of very rational things. You know, I'm standing here looking at about 1,000 books. We have a lot of rationality on our side, but yes, we're now going beyond that. One of the real problems we have in the church in America is we've come to value order above life, and people get excited, things start to happen, and the leaders of the church kind of panic. They want an orderly program service, and so they don't have that in Africa, as you probably remember.
No, as much as based upon emotion, but they're really wonderful and warm people in there.
Oh, yeah.
They're, you know, of course, Christianity is really growing. I thought it was so interesting. The impact on Uganda. You want to talk a little bit about Uganda? I mean, here was a country that where Idi Amin was in power. He killed 250,000 people. He was a Muslim. He was a cannibal. You know, one of the really horrible, decrepit people, of course.
Yeah.
He got out of there and went to stay with our good friends in Saudi Arabia, where he remained, you know, without ever being punished for all the people he slaughtered and ate and things of that sort. I have a book written by his former minister of health, who talked about how he would, you know, go in with his enemies after they had been dead, and he'd come out licking his fingers, the blood off of them. I mean, incredible that this man could have, you know, been one of the great leaders of Africa and applauded by the other leaders of Africa at the meetings, the OAU, and yet Uganda has really been transformed, hasn't it?
Yes, Uganda. Kenya is being transformed also. I have high hopes for one of the real basket cases, which is Zimbabwe. Used to be called Rhodesia, and they've had a man there for many years now named Robert Mugabe. I guess you're familiar with him.
Well, very well. We put him in power. I remember when I was in Africa, when our government was demanding that the Rhodesian people accept him as their leader. We would not allow them to elect their own black leader, Bishop Mesuweo. And when he was elected by a legal election, why, we demanded that they have new elections so that Mugabe could get in. And we promised that nothing would ever happen there.
Yeah.
We would always guarantee their freedom and the rule of law. And, of course, America's promise, and $5 to get you a cup of coffee anywhere in the world. Today, the people are starving. Almost a third of the population has fled. Total lawlessness. The judges are regularly beaten up if they don't come up with the conclusions that Robert Mugabe wants. A total basket case.
Yeah, the spiritual problem underlying that is about 25 years ago, he was receiving regular Christian input from good counselors, and he was really on the fence about where his life was going to go and the direction it was going to take, and he finally just basically opted for the ancestor worship and all the other stuff that kind of goes along with it in Africa. And so his taste for Jesus Christ and Christianity obviously waned badly, which tells you what can happen when somebody shuts the door on the Lord.
All right, fine. So Rhodesia certainly is today as a Baxter's case, but in many of the other countries of Africa, why, there really is this growing Christian movement. I think this is really what's so exciting, is that it really is beginning, at least in some areas, to transform Africa. What about Nigeria?
Nigeria is very, very outstanding. You'll notice in my book, Mega Shift, that I quote Nigeria stories once in a while, but Nigeria, along with Indonesia, you kind of have to be extra careful because there are so many strange stories that just don't check out. So I have checked out some, and even after you flush the, 30% or so that are bogus, you have some startling stories of what God is doing and bringing people back from the dead and bringing millions of people. I think Bonnke had one crusade where slightly over a million people registered Decision for Christ in one evening. That's just astonishing.
A million people. I mean, that's almost beyond our comprehension here in America.
It is. It really is. But they trained what, 600,000 counselors, good methodical German training there, and they had, over 1,000 doctors up near the front to officially register all the healings that came forward, and so they're doing a lot of things right, and you'll see a lot more out of Nigeria. It's the biggest country in Africa in population, and it's growing.
Well, now, of course, it's very difficult for rational people to believe that people are going to be brought back from the dead. Of course, we know that it happened in biblical times. We've all heard the story of Lazarus, and then there was another woman, a daughter of somebody, who was brought. I'm not sure whether that. I think that was one of the disciples that actually brought the girl back from the dead. But be that as it may, those things happened in long past times. You have documented what 50 cases or more where people have been brought back from the dead. How do you actually document that these things are real and not simply imaginary or illusions?
Well, look in the book. I've got names, phone numbers, email addresses, whatnot. You have to check them out. I haven't personally flown to every place, but these reports are not coming in from some central internet screwball distributing rumors. They're coming in from reliable people in many traditions, many organizations. It's very sudden. Since about 1985 or 1990, these things have happened. And, of course, I very much realize the credibility problem. But as a matter of fact, could I just recount one instance?
Go ahead.
In 2003, I was in New Delhi, and I was just leaving, and I phoned up a pastor friend of mine who's got now 26,000 former Hindus that have been saved and baptized in his church network. And I got pictures of this kid in my book, by the way. I asked him, I've got this credibility problem in America with the resurrection. Could you just send somebody over who has come back from the dead? So he sends that over a little boy, a seven-year-old boy named Arjun Das, and you can see his picture and his mother's picture and so forth. And he was electrocuted, died at age 5, and still has some nasty scars I saw behind his left ear where the wires hit, accidentally electrocuted, and he died about 6 in the evening, and they took him to a medical clinic and worked on him with all the stuff that you know about, the paddles, electroshock, adrenaline, the whole nine yards. And I just couldn't get him off a flat line, and so they gave the body back to the parents, told them to call the coroner or whatever you call in India, but instead they called the church. They called my friend, and he called a little 60-year-old woman named Savitri, A sabi tree is a street sweeper. I mean, all she ever did in her whole life was sweep the street. She's what they used to call an untouchable. Now they call them Dalits. They are the lowest of the low. And so she comes over about 8 o'clock at night with a couple of friends, and they get together with their parents, and they stand around in a little circle around this corpse, and they just start praying and praying and praying their heads off and crying out to God and weeping, and they pray all night long until 4 o'clock the next morning, and bingo, little Arjun sits up, no brain damage, no problem, and he's as healthy a kid as you ever want to see. And as I was parting company with him after we took some photos, I said to Savitri through a translator, now, you've been saved since 92, you've been doing ministry kind of stuff since 96 or 97. How many of these resurrections have you been involved with? And she said, 16. And at that point, my little neat world started spinning around. You know, I was raised as a fundamentalist, and supposedly, you know, in some circles, the last miracles that happened were, you know, almost 2,000 years ago. And so I'm looking at this little woman who can't read. I mean, I can't give you her email because she can't read, no computer, no nothing. Former street sweeper. And so this is the kind of empowerment we are finding now. This is why we are seeing such a tremendous switch overseas. And so America, Western Europe are kind of backwaters, and these things are just now getting to us.
All right. Well, it's really an amazing book, and the amazing things that you talk about, miracles actually taking place. Well, we know God, that God certainly can. He can do just about anything he wants to, because he doesn't have to, mediate through the same time and space that we do,
right,
and matter as we do. And the wonderful stories in the Bible about Jesus being able to appear in a locked room, that just can't happen. But I believe it can happen, because I believe there is a spiritual dimension there, and I believe, of course, God is capable of anything. If he could create the heaven and the earth, why time and matter would not be really of any concern at all to him.
Yeah.
So you, as you certainly talk about the things that are happening, of course, you feel that at least throughout the rest of the world, there's this tremendous shift towards Christianity, not here in the West, but certainly throughout the rest of the world.
Oh, yeah. I'm looking at some statistics in mega shifts right here, and I note that Kazakhstan, big country, went from just 100 evangelicals in 1990 to 6,000 now. And over in Cambodia, they only had 200 Christians back in 1990. Now they've got 400,000, and the numbers just keep rolling right along. I don't want to bore your listeners with a bunch of statistics, but actually, there's a couple of states in India, Nagaland and Mizoram, that claim to be 100% Christian. That's unheard of for a Hindu country.
Yeah, well, it really is. And, of course, these are things we're not hearing about here, which I thought really, I was a little skeptical when I started reading your book, but I think you've got a lot of fascinating material in there. And when we get back, I will tell our listeners how to get copies of your book and learn more about what you're talking about. Mega Shift. Our guest is James Rutz, is it?
Yes.
Rutz. Okay, James Rutz. Well, we'll be back in just a moment here, and welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening, James Rutz. His book is Mega Shift, and of course the whole underlying theme is that there truly are miraculous things primarily happening in other countries. And of course, we're not hearing about this. We hear about what's going on in China. I know one of my friends just came back. In fact, those of you who listen to our programs regularly will recognize the name Barrett Cho. She just came back from China, telling me how exciting it is to see the church growing there under constant oppression by the Chinese communist government, which incidentally we seem to be doing everything we can to support, not the Christians, but the Chinese communist tyrants over there. But be that as it may, the church is prospering under terrible, terrible persecution. And of course, in Cambodia, that's you were saying about how many Christians are there today?
I believe it's 400,000. Let me look at the numbers right quick again here. We're going to get that right. So many numbers floating around in my head.
Well, don't worry about it. I thought that you just quoted the figure, so I thought you'd have to write your figure.
Yeah, well.
don't worry about it. I think you
said. Yeah, 400,000.
400,000.
Page 81.
But really, of course, the fact that Christianity is having such an impact in India today. Mm-hmm. You know, here's a nation of almost a billion people anyway. It's probably the second largest country in the entire world. And the fact that Christianity is spreading there, and of course, all we hear about is the persecution of Christians over there. But the Christians are holding their own pretty well then.
Yes, it's amazing. They don't ask us to pray that the persecution would stop. They just ask for courage and boldness, which is awesome.
Now, I know, Chris, you talked there about they're planting rabbit churches. Would you like to sort of develop that idea? I thought that was an interesting concept of rabbit churches rather than elephant churches.
Well, rabbit, I won't go into statistics, but it works very, very fast. Typically, when you have a network of house churches, they don't have to wait until they find a pastor who's been to seminary. They don't have to build a building. They don't have to go through a lot of stuff to start. They just start here 1 week, and a few weeks later they branch off somebody else in another house. And the typical well-grounded house church that knows what they're doing are about doubling every year. And as you can imagine, you keep doubling, you've really got something after a while. So we're seeing now, Guatemala, is a little closer to home, is 44% born-again Christians now. El Salvador is 53.6% born-again Christians. And in fact, if you go all over Latin America as a whole on a Sunday morning, you're going to find more evangelicals in church than Roman Catholics. It's amazing. We think of that whole region as being almost totally Catholic, but it's not.
Well, I think the problem is a growing disillusion with the Catholic leadership there. So there's a disillusionment with the Catholic leadership here in this country because of the homosexual situation. But so many of the Catholics and the leaders in South America have been involved with the liberation theology and the Marxists, and the people know that's the last thing they want. I mean, they want to be free people. Everybody in the world wants to be free, but you're not going to get it through a Marxist government for sure.
Yeah. Dr. Stan, I know that you're very concerned with world systems and some of these oppressive structures have been with us for centuries and centuries. And the interesting thing about the house church, which is the main subject of my book, Megashift, really, is that it reverses the traditional top-down sort of stuff.
Hold that thought for just a moment here. Well, Dr. Stan and our guest this evening is James Rutz, his book, Megashift, and he, of course, is talking about the explosion of evangelical Christianity throughout South America, throughout India, throughout China, throughout Africa. And what he's pointing out is that this is a complete change in the structure of the church. Rather than the top-down, where, of course, you have an authoritarian structure and a minister who's in charge of this church, these house churches are really built from the bottom up. They're built by the people, not by a hierarchy. Would that be a fair statement?
Yeah, it is. It's getting back to the New Testament sort of thing, where they either met in the temple or they moved around from house to house, and as it says in 1 Corinthians 14, you're supposed to be ready with every person coming up with a song or a bit of teaching or a prayer or a bit of encouragement, whatever, you know. It's the little guy. So rather than just going off to church to hear the one paid professional standing up there and doing his best to get everybody charged up for another week, you're thinking all week long, okay, what can I be bringing to the brothers and sisters next Sunday or whenever it is you meet? And so it becomes a 24/7 kind of a thing. And instead of having a two-tiered Christianity with the clergy on top and everybody else on the bottom, you now have teams of people. And everybody in your house team is committed to supporting you. And they learn to know you and love you over a process of time. They know what you're going through. They pray for you. You get stuck. You can phone them at 3 in the morning and say, help, I need help. And so people are getting the kind of help and support and growth they never could get in a big mass audience kind of a thing. It's a reversal of the traditional top-down thing we've had not only in the church, but, of course, the military, the government, corporations, everything is top-down.
I notice, of course, you have a lot of email, websites to go to, and you talk about the home churches right here in this own, our own country, getting away from the top-down churches we have so many of, getting to the home church movement, which is really growing here in America.
Yeah, we don't have very many really solid statistics on it because we're not really part of what you could call organized religion. But we're guessing that probably in this last year we've gone from maybe 2,500 house churches to about 5,000 this year, just about doubled. And I would expect the same thing next year and the year after that.
Well, I think that's really so interesting. We get calls regularly from our listeners all across America. You know, they may be in Ohio, and they say, well, do you know of a good church I can go to here? And I say, I don't know any churches at all in Ohio. But, you know, then I suggest that they get involved in the home church movement and give them the references where they can get more information. And I think it's really so important that so many people today cannot find a church they really feel comfortable in, because we seem to have sort of changed the music and the message and the structure of our conventional churches. And so I think that's really so significant that you are actually encouraging home churches.
Yeah, not only encouraging people to find one, but to start one. And a couple of ways you can go on that. One is just go to megashift.com, which is my website, and that will link you through to some of our networks, and also give you links to other people's websites. And they actually have maps. You just click on your home state, and you can find out where people are meeting. But we really like for people to just invite in 10 or 12 friends, neighbors, for dinner. Everybody loves food. And frankly, the fastest-growing house churches are those that have a meal somewhere in there. So it's not just a ceremony. This is friends. This is family.
All right, fine. And then, of course, they take turns giving the service of the Bible reading, something of that sort?
Well, it's even a little wilder than that, Dr. Stan. We try to avoid programming, and some of our house churches will have what we call a facilitator, which is about the lightest word we can find, just to get things going, make sure things don't get too far off track and end on time. But most of them, and the kind of thing I encourage, is to have it open. Because here's the difference. Rather than God being restricted to working through a top-down leadership, suddenly in a house church, you have everyone listening to the Holy Spirit, and when somebody says one thing, then God will touch your heart with something that he brings to mind, and you'll open your mouth and say that. And somebody else has got a prayer, somebody else has got a word of encouragement, somebody else has got a scripture, and you can have the same group of people for 50 meetings in a row, and none of them are the same, because the Lord is directing the thing directly rather than through a leader.
All right, fine. Well, we're going to be back here in just a moment or two. When we do return, why, we welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. That's 464-8295. So give us a call. Our guest this evening, James Rutz, and his book, Megashift. And his website is www.megashift.com. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening, James Rutz. We're talking about his book, Megashift, which is really a very unusual book, not anything like I've read before. Certainly going into the amazing things that are happening all throughout the rest of the world, not here in America, because we're too smart for this sort of thing here, at least we think we are. But God seems to be working in so many of the other countries where the people are impoverished and oppressed, and it seems almost that the more oppression there is, the greater the Spirit of the Lord is in bringing people into a personal relationship with Him. Here in America, why, we have so much, a lot of people feel they don't need God. Well, of course, they're sadly mistaken. Everybody needs God. But, certainly in the other country where people are simply, have to be totally reliant upon God. You even talk about times when people really are without food. They travel simply based upon faith. You want to tell a few of those stories?
Yeah, one of the sadder stories in India, a friend of mine named Gas Ram was 6 years old when his father went crazy. I mean, just insane. He couldn't cope with the poverty anymore, and he wigged out, and so there wasn't any money coming in, and they had to yank him out of school, and so he never learned to read. And just poor, ordinary, laboring class, Hindu, lower caste guy. Then he got to be 22 years old, and he got saved. And at that point, he really, really wanted to learn to read the Bible. Very important for all Christians, read the Bible, but again, no money, no time really to sit and learn English. So one day, he just mooched somebody's Hindi Bible. He was a Hindi speaker. Sits down, opens it up, and looks around at the page and points to a word and says, "Lord, what does that mean?" And he listened to his heart, and the Lord spoke to him inwardly as what that particular word meant. He said, "Oh, okay. Lord, what does this mean?" And he points to another word, and God spoke to him again. Within 2 weeks, he was reading fluently. 3 months later, he was standing up in front of a room full of medical students lecturing on Jesus Christ. A room full of Brahmins and high caste Hindus. This is just absolutely not done in India. And he was an untouchable, still is, by the caste system. And so, God is able to take people at the bottom of the pile with no status at all and make something out of them. Something much closer to home, a little city south of where I live here is called Pueblo. There's a gal down there who, I'm just talking to last week, and she at one point had broken her ankle, just badly fractured, shattered her ankle, and there's a lot of pieces of bone, and the doctors were looking at a...
Hold that thought here for just a moment, please. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is James Rutz, and of course we're talking about his book, Megashift, and he's talking about some of the miracles that have taken place in other countries, and India is one of them, and he was just talking about this little girl who's shattered her ankle. Was she in India or where?
No, this was just south of where I live in Pueblo, Colorado, and she was running along and just shattered her ankle, had bones all over the place. The doctors weren't too hopeful that they could, you know, really piece it together very well, while she was in a house church meeting. And the obvious problem, she's on crutches. And so somebody said, "We got to pray for our sister Jean here." So they all gathered around. Here's this little two-year-old boy who belongs to one of the people in the house church. And he comes running over, and he puts his little two-year-old hands around her ankle, and she immediately felt all the bones snapping back into place instantly, and her broken ankle was healed. Right here in America. Two-year-old kid, you know. I mean, he's nothing. What kind of spiritual status does a two-year-old have? But God is now beginning to use little folks like you and me without the necessary ordination papers and whatnot.
You mean without a big television camera and a big a big assembly like some of the people, of course, who I'm a little skeptical of, that have their miracle healing services?
Yeah, well, I'm a little skeptical, too, but, you know, I think that's part of the picture. We're not declaring war on the traditional church or the big media people, but I think the Holy Spirit's emphasis now is going to be on the little people. And, frankly, some of the sharper pastors, traditional pastors, are getting on with this. Rick Warren, who wrote Purpose-Driven Life, he now is actually kind of doing the missionary thing at Saddleback Church in California. He's, so to speak, laying hands on people, his own members, and sending them out as missionaries to found and start networks of house churches. Well, this is something different from having your cell church program. Most of the churches in America have some kind of a cell program. Cell program is just a subdivision of the central church. And come next Sunday, everybody in the cell is supposed to be back in the pew again and putting their money into the plate. But when you send somebody out to start a house church, that's something really different. It's like sending out a missionary. And now they're done. I even had the report that he's got more people in his house church network at Saddleback than he does on a Sunday morning, which is like 20,000 people. Amazing.
Well, we're not. We're a little skeptical about Rick Warren, but we won't get on into that this evening, because that talk about a structured system. Why, if you object to anything going on in the church, why they immediately get rid of you. But be that as it may, Well, let's get back, of course, to the things that you feel are happening across America. And I really, of course, am concerned, really very pleased to see the growth of the home churches here, because many people have left their major denominational churches simply because they were going into an increasingly structured type of church. In other words, where everything was regimented and controlled, and and they were changing both the message and the music and the entire structure of the church, so that there really it was total top down. With the minister, of course, being a figure, a totally authoritarian figure, which I don't think is what Christianity was ever supposed to be.
No, it wasn't. The biggest thing people complain about, actually, is missing God in the church service. They can put up with a lot of the regimentation, but Sunday after Sunday, they go to church, and they got these problems and discouragements, and they get some encouragement from the sermon and the singing, and they go back home, and they got the same problems, and they haven't met God face-to-face. And that's really what they miss the most. And you know, George Barna and other people that do polling, like Gallup, have talked to people, and you'd think that these people leaving the church would be the worst Christians, the backsliders. Actually, what they're finding is that they're a little stronger than average on typical bunch leaving the church. Stronger than average, and they're not leaving the church because they've lost their faith, but in order to preserve their faith.
I think that's really such an important point. They're not leaving the church because they've lost the faith, but because they want to preserve it, and they feel that what they're getting, at least in so many churches today, is a lot of entertainment and watered-down scripture, but there, of course, is no energy there.
Yes, yes.
So, all right, let's go to Roger, who's calling from Allentown, Pennsylvania. And again, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California, at 464-8295. Hi, Roger. How are you doing tonight?
Fine. Thank you, gentlemen. And I wanted to ask, I think it should be quite the encouragement to the quick, if not the dead, to learn that besides Jesus, Benny Hinn hasn't cornered the market on raising from the dead.
Right.
Now, he repented of that, of course, once challenged to supply even a single name. And then he went back to claiming it afterwards anyway. But your response to that?
Well, I don't track Benny Hinn. Sorry. I suppose he's a nice guy, but I just can't speak to that.
All right. I think that's a very good answer. Anything else, Roger?
No, I'll let it go at that.
All right, fine. Thanks very much. Well, I think that certainly I don't think God necessarily always works when the television cameras are rolling. Uh-huh. I think that God works in his own way, and of course I think he responds to a contrite heart, not necessarily to a really a sort of a stage managed program. So
yes, the most I've seen is that some people that have done more than a dozen resurrections, done is a strange word, but who've been involved with them, will go to where the dead person is, and rather than just beginning to pray, they will preach a sermon to whoever's standing around. Sometimes, if it's a small village, there'll be dozens and dozens of people who'll flock around to see what's going on, and they'll talk about salvation, about Jesus Christ, and then they pray for the resurrection. So, resurrection first, sermon first, and resurrection later.
Well, there have been instances where they've done this, and they've had the prayer, and the people haven't been revived. I mean, certainly we would always hear about the case where the people came back to life, but what happens, of course, if they pray and it doesn't take place?
Well, they never get in my book.
Well, you do have. How many cases have you actually recorded in your book? I know for many, many countries you list, but I'm sure many of those countries have been more than one reported case of a...
Oh, yes. I wouldn't be surprised if there's been over 1,000, really. The main... biggest countries are China and Mexico, and been quite a few in India also. But it's really, really hard to track all that.
Well, you talked in your book about one minister. I think he was in Africa someplace. I saw his picture in the book, and he was black. And of course, he was making all of these things, telling women they were going to have barren women, they were going to have children, and these women are going to have boys, and these women were going to have girls. And some of the people, of course, who were working in the area felt he was tied into the occult. Do you know anything at all about that?
Oh, yeah. I got very suspicious when I saw the stuff. The man is highly gifted, just a tremendous prophetic, whatever you want to call it, and so this rouses my suspicions whenever you see really neon stuff like that. And so I called my brother and said, hey, do you know anybody in Nairobi? And turned out his best friend in college was a dentist in Nairobi. And so I talked to him and I said, go shake hands with this guy and see if you can figure out anything about him. And turns out, pretty sizable church, thousands of people, but he liked him, and his name is Dr. Mariano. And so he invited Dr. Mariano out to eat with him on several occasions, and they got along great. And to further complicate the story, he says, you know, I'd like for you to speak in my church next Sunday morning. He said, well, no, I'm a dentist. I'm not a preacher. He said, no, please, I got to have to say something. Well, the church was mostly a Kikuyu-speaking church, so he didn't know any Kikuyu. So he said, well, I'll say something in English, and some people will understand. He gets up there in the pulpit the next Sunday morning to speak for about 20 minutes. He opens his mouth, and he starts speaking Kikuyu. And people are jumping up and down, and some people are crying. And obviously something great is going on. He just has a vague idea of what he's saying. And in fact, afterwards, his wife, who does speak Kikuyu, came up to him and said, how'd you do that? So we have a case there which not only looked suspicious when we went to investigate it, but it got validated and became even more strange. And so I'm, you know, debriefing Dr. Mariano, who's been very helpful. And it's just the sort of thing that rearranges your head, frankly, Dr. Stan.
Well, nothing is impossible for our Lord. I'm convinced of that. For our listeners out there in Kenya, there are two tribal groups. One is Maasai, the other is Kikuyu. So they're the two major tribal groups there. And I suppose this is primarily a Kikuyu church.
Right. Yeah.
Well, anyway, of course, Africa is a wonderful, wonderful place. And it's just been so tragic for so many years. It's been so impoverished, and it was, of course, oppressed while the colonial powers were there. And once the colonial powers were there, instead of getting better, it was getting worse, and total chaos in so many of the countries. Mm-hmm. And of course, but the only thing that's ever going to change Africa is Christianity. Not going to be the Muslim faith, because that's a top down, whatever the imam says, you better do it, or you're going to be in real trouble.
Yeah.
Whereas Christianity is the one faith that offers people freedom. I mean, that's the wonderful thing about it. It's wonderful because you're answerable not to government, but to God. And as William Penn had said so well so many years ago, those will not be ruled by God. They'll be ruled by tyrants.
Yes. Well, they are changing Africa. The Christians, the intercessors are really doing it. And more and more you're going to see a completely different continent there.
And of course, in Nigeria, we were asked about why this had been under the control of a Muslim military government for so long. Recently, they had elections, I don't know, 4, 5, 6 years ago, somewhere in there. And now they have a Christian president, and of course, the country is beginning to prosper. And although there's still the friction between the Christians and the Muslims, it's a predominantly Christian country.
Uh-huh. Yes.
All right, fine. Well, you know, you give so many examples in your book, which really, of course, gives it a tremendous authority. And I'm there in the back of the book, of course, looking at all your sources of information. And I'm sure you've checked all these stories out, or as many of them as you possibly can. How do you actually verify, you know, the various stories you've come up with? Do you talk to the people or try to track them down, or what?
A little of everything. I try to stay away from the internet rumor mill, deal with people we know and networks we know and reliable organizations. It makes a lot of difference because, as you know, there's plenty of fluff out there. But, like one of the stories I mentioned is an old friend of mine, a wealthy man who went out to one of Reinhard Bonnke's crusades in, Botswana. He was up there on the platform and just watching things from the bird's eye point of view. And the next day at lunch, he finally got to talk to Dr. Bonnke. And Dr. Bonnke is kind of shuffling his feet and looking at the floor. And he says, hey, Larry, I'm sorry you had to come on such a slow night. We only had eight blind people last night that received their sight. I wish you could have come some other time. Of course, most American preachers would be real happy to see eight blind people healed all in one.
Well, apparently they have massive healing sessions. Now, of course, when we see these things, I remember when we used to have them here, with Oral Roberts, and of course he would put on these sessions, and I was always very skeptical that, a lot of this was just stage managed.
Uh-huh.
This isn't really what's happening in Africa, is it?
Well, in some cases it is, some cases it isn't. You just have to be discriminating. In Nigeria, there's sort of a psychology among the clergy that if you haven't been involved in some super-duper supernatural event, you're nobody. And so they'll go through all sorts of really dumb things to try to pretend they're doing miracles and they haven't. So you got to watch out for that stuff. But I think in Mega Shift you'll find some of the best stories that have really been verified come from good people.
Well, I think it's a fascinating book. What sort of response are you getting? As you you must be doing a fair amount of talk radio. What sort of response are you getting when you present your story?
Oh, usually very good. I was on the 700 Club with Pat Robertson, and he got so excited he asked me to speak to his chapel service. I've now become a national columnist on worldnetdaily.com, and that was started and is run by Joseph Farah. You've probably come across him.
Joseph, a personal friend of mine.
Uh-huh. Well, for the last 15 years, he's had this terrible degenerative foot condition, some rare thing, and some of his toe bones were breaking, and he was in pain 24 hours a day for 15 years, and somebody gave him my book, and he read it and said to his wife, well, Rutz says that we can pray for stuff like this just on our own. So he and his wife, Elizabeth, started praying for his feet, which were so painful. And after they prayed for about 1 minute or two, there was this feeling of fire running, something like fire running through his feet. And poof, all the pain is gone just instantly after 15 years of constant pain.
Well, you probably had an immediate convert.
Oh, wow. Well, he was a Christian before that.
I know he was, but to actually believing in the power of prayer, I think that sometimes we rational people with a lot of college degrees and all really don't perhaps put as much emphasis and belief in the power of prayer that really is there. And if we can harness that, why, of course, we can accomplish great and wonderful things, not through our own efforts, but through our Lord.
Yes. The Lord is just waiting for us to get in gear. And so that's what the book is all about. Could I give a phone number?
You sure do. Go ahead.
Call 888-OPEN-123.
888-OPEN-123.
Yeah.
All right, fine. And
there's business hours for that.
All right, fine. And, Chris, now, what are you doing? Are you mainly just selling the book, or are you helping to organize these home churches or what?
Not much of an organizer. There's other people that are really people persons, and that's not me. I'm an idea man. I'm a writer. I've been a full-time writer for 31 years, and I've written for a lot of the really huge Christian organizations you've heard of, and I do secular advertising writing also in alternative health publications. You're probably familiar with some of the names that I write for. I got Dr. Atkins off the ground, and I've written for Whitaker and Williams and William Campbell Douglas and so forth. So that's been my niche, and so I'm very much involved in some of these names that you know.
Well, I know William Campbell Douglas. Certainly I know all the names that you talk about. Dr. Whitaker does a great job. Well, anyway, of course, I think that's a fascinating, fascinating subject. And for our listeners out there, the book is Megashift, The Best News Since Year One. And it starts out simply talking about the things that we remember having occurred, when our Lord was here. The true miracles, the raising of the dead, the feeding of the masses, remember the two loaves and the one fish or something of the sort. And,
yeah.
And you point out that this sort of thing has happened in
recent years. Yeah, my own housekeeper had that situation happen to her. She was running a conference for young people and had $30 to buy food for the entire conference for several days, and they just put together the best buffet they could and stood back and prayed, and her eyes just about came out of her head when she saw people pulling maybe 80 pieces of chicken out of a little pan that probably held 15 or 20 pieces to start with. Couldn't believe it.
Well, I think God can accomplish anything. Of course, we always want to be skeptical, and yet I think that sometimes we have to see it with our own eyes, and if you're not going to see it with your own eyes, then your book is certainly next best, because it's
a very... You got a few pictures in there for people.
Right, we'll be back in just a moment here. We've got 3 more minutes to go. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening, James Rutz, his book, A Mega Shift. And if you'd like to get that telephone number out just one more time, and so people, because sometimes people just don't have a pencil in hand the first time.
Yeah, 888-OPEN-123.
888-OPEN-123, and of course, if you're interested in getting the book, and is it available on Amazon and Borders and the other?
Yeah, it's available a little slow there. I think World Net Daily would get it to you a little faster.
All right, fine. Well, we'll get it from James. Anyway, of course, I think it's a significant book. I'm glad that that Joe Sport is feeling better. He's never mentioned that to me when we've met in the past at meetings across the country. But he's certainly doing a great job of reaching out across the nation. And of course, he's carried some articles on your book as well. So I think that'll certainly will have quite an impact. He's got quite a following. Well, what's the message would you like to leave? We've got just 2 minutes before I'm going to let you go. So what's the message you want to leave with our listeners tonight?
Well, I'd like to encourage them to take a giant step up in their spiritual life. I sat in pews for 50 years in some darn good churches, churches I'm really proud of. But God is moving people ahead at the same time he's moving us back 2,000 years to the original house-to-house kind of church. And he wants us to take on more responsibility, which means that, sure, you can complain about how things are going in the world, but you also do something about it. And instead of just being an observer, part of an audience, God wants you to be the kind of thing that Jesus promised when he was standing there in the temple, looking at all the religious stuff going on. He finally couldn't take it anymore, and he started yelling, "If anyone believes in me, out of his heart shall flow rivers of living water." And that's what we want to see. Each person, not a spiritual consumer, but a spiritual producer. And that's the future for what God wants of all of us.
Well, it sounds like, and I really know this to be true, is that God is moving throughout the rest of the world and bringing profound changes in many of these societies, which will really transform the countries of Africa and Central and South America and certainly of India and China. I only hope and pray that we can do the same thing here at home, but it's going to take, you know, I think a return to the traditional beliefs rather than the more glossy sort of a feel-good type of Christianity
Definitely.
We have in America today.
Absolutely.
Well,
Absolutely.
I want to thank you so very much for being with us here this evening. It's been a real pleasure, and perhaps we can get you on to some of our other programs.
Okay.
Good night, and God bless you.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Well, this is our guest this evening is Mr. James Rutz, and I will tell you I'm fascinated reading his book. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and certainly we hope you enjoyed the program we have this evening. Now, certainly I'm very concerned about some of the things that are happening in Christianity today, which are not getting back to the fundamentals that Mr. Rutz is talking about. And if you were interested in knowing perhaps something about the church growth movement which you have in America, which I think is leading people away from the traditional gospel, we carry several books. One is Deceived on Purpose. The other is Who's Driving the Purpose-Driven Church. And then, of course, we have a four-tape set on the church growth movement. We have a video. It's put out by our good friend Dr. Bob Klink called Diaprax in the Church. And all this goes into what's happening in the Christian church today that is leading us away from what is really happening throughout the rest of the world. And really, what's happening in the rest of the world is really so exciting as the people are getting back to fundamental Christianity. What's happening in America today is we're changing the structure of the church to a top-down a system where all authority lies with the minister. It's a managerial structure. We're getting into this whole idea of globalism, but not certainly believing in the traditions of the church and the miracles of the church and the power of the Holy Spirit. But how can we manage things and make them run more efficiently? How can we get rid of resistors, people who don't want to go along with this? How can we confuse people with multiple Bible translations? How we can have facilitated meetings that will not bring people closer to the Lord, but get them, of course, into a support group, psychological support groups. So we are going exactly the wrong direction in America. Anyway, if you'd like more information on the church growth movement, we do have a great deal of information there. If you'd like to know what's happening in other churches where they're really renewing their Christian belief, why I certainly recommend James Rutz's book, Megashift. I think it's a fascinating book. In fact, we may very well carry the book ourselves here. We haven't quite decided yet, but we think it's a fascinating book with a great deal to offer. Now, for those of you who would like to really understand the spiritual battle that is going on in the world today, and certainly I saw that when I was in Africa, because, as we mentioned, there was a tremendous occult presence in Africa. There were witch doctors, and that, of course, many of them were deeply involved in the occult, and many of them truly had supernatural power. And sometimes they did have the power to heal. Some of them, of course, were frauds. But as I mentioned, so many of my patients when I practiced in Africa would go to the witch doctor before they would go to the white doctor. And you must understand that there are these powerful occult forces all throughout Africa, but those powerful occult forces are growing with tremendous strength here in the United States. Let me suggest a book which I think is very important, and that is The Hidden Dangers of the Rainbow by Constance Cumby, which we do carry. That's The Hidden Dangers of the Rainbow. If you haven't read my book, The Brotherhood of Darkness, you need to get it and read it to understand the very essence of the spiritual battle that is going on today. And then I think that we really are going to have to increasingly come to know how to rely upon the Lord and to pray to the Lord and look to Him to change society, because we're not certainly going to be able to do this on our own. I mean, man always thinks that he's going to be able to solve our problems, and he's not going to be able to solve our problems because he's always looking to the wrong source. He's looking to himself rather than to our Lord, and the only hope there is for America, the only hope there is for a better society will be that coming from the Lord, transforming the minds and hearts of people. And it may very well be that China begins moving towards Christianity and the rest of the world moves towards Christianity, that here America, which for so many years was the bulwark of the world Christian movement, will fade into insignificance, because our country has done everything they could to turn away from God. We've repudiated the very essence of His teaching. Pray for America and pray for revival. Pray for our leaders and think about maybe even getting into a home church. But please remember to pray for Radio Liberty. For our provision and protection, our number 1-800-544-8927. Until Monday, may the Lord be with you.